Clausewitz, oracle of German military thought, had ordained a quick victory by decisive battle as the first object in offensive war. Occupation of the enemy's territory and gaining control of his resources was secondary. To speed an early decision was essential. Time counted above all else. Anything that protracted a campaign, Clausewitz condemned. Gradual reduction of the enemy or a war of attrition he feared like the pit of hell. He wrote in the Decade of Waterloo, and his works had been accepted as the Bible of strategy ever since. To achieve decisive victory, Schlieffen fixed upon a strategy derived from Hannibal and the Battle of Cannae. The dead general who mesmerized Schlieffen had been dead a very long time. 2,000 years had passed since Hannibal's classic double envelopment of the Romans at Cannae. Field gun and machine gun had replaced bow and arrow and slingshot, Schlieffen wrote, but the principles of strategy remain unchanged. The enemy's front is not the objective. The essential thing is to crush the enemy's flanks and complete the extermination by attack upon his rear. Under Schlieffen, envelopment became the fetish and frontal attack the anathema of the German general staff. Schlieffen's first plan to include the violation of Belgium was formulated in 1899. It called for cutting across the corner of Belgium east of the Meuse. Enlarged with each successive year, by 1905 it had expanded into a huge enveloping right-wing sweep in which the German armies would cross Belgium from Liège to Brussels before turning southward, where they could take advantage of the open country of Flanders to march against France. Everything depended upon a quick decision against France, and even the long way around through Flanders would be quicker than laying siege to the fortress line across the common border. Schlieffen did not have enough divisions for a double envelopment of France a la Cannae. For this he substituted a heavily one-sided right wing that would spread across the whole of Belgium on both sides of the Meuse, sweep down through the country like a monstrous hayrake, cross the Franco-Belgian frontier along its entire width, and descend upon Paris along the valley of the Oise. The German mass would come between the capital and the French armies, which, drawn back to meet the menace, would be caught away from their fortified areas in the decisive battle of annihilation. Essential to the plan was a deliberately weak German left wing on the Alsace-Lorraine front, which would tempt the French in that area forward into a sack between Metz and the Vosges. It was expected that the French, intent upon liberating their lost provinces, would attack here, and it was considered so much the better for the success of the German plan if they did, for they could be held in the sack by the German left wing while the main victory was obtained from behind. In the back of Schlieffen's mind always glimmered the hope that as battle unfolded, a counterattack by his left wing could be mounted in order to bring about a true double envelopment, the colossal Cannae of his dreams. Sternly saving his greatest strength for the right wing, he did not yield to that vaulting ambition in his plan. But the lure of the left wing remained to tempt his successors. Thus the Germans came to Belgium. Decisive battle dictated envelopment, and envelopment dictated the use of Belgian territory. The German general staff pronounced it a military necessity. Kaiser and Chancellor accepted it with more or less equanimity. Whether it was advisable, whether it was even expedient in view of the probable effect on world opinion, especially on neutral opinion, was irrelevant. That it seemed necessary to the triumph of German arms was the only criterion. Germans had imbibed from 1870 the lesson that arms and war were the sole source of German greatness. They had been taught by Field Marshal von der Goltz in his book The Nation in Arms that we have won our position through the sharpness of our sword, not through the sharpness of our mind. The decision to violate Belgian neutrality followed easily. Character is fate, the Greeks believed. 100 years of German philosophy went into the making of this decision, in which the seed of self-destruction lay embedded, waiting for its hour. The voice was Schlieffen's, but the hand was the hand of Fichte, who saw the German people chosen by Providence to occupy the supreme place in the history of the universe, of Hegel, who saw them leading the world to a glorious destiny of compulsory Kultur, of Nietzsche, who told them that supermen were above ordinary controls, of Treitschke, who set the increase of power as the highest moral duty of the state. Of the whole German people who called their temporal ruler the All-Highest. What made the Schlieffen Plan was not Clausewitz and the Battle of Cannae, but the body of accumulated egoism which suckled the German people and created a nation fed on the desperate delusion of the will that deems itself absolute. The goal, decisive battle, was a product of the victories over Austria and France in 1866 and 1870. Dead battles, like dead generals, hold the military mind in their dead grip, and Germans, no less than other peoples, prepare for the last war. They staked everything on decisive battle in the image of Hannibal. But even the ghost of Hannibal might have reminded Schlieffen that though Carthage won at Cannae, Rome won the war. Old Field Marshal Moltke, in 1890, foretold that the next war might last 7 years or 30, because the resources of a modern state were so great it would not know itself to be beaten after a single military defeat and would not give up. His nephew and namesake, who succeeded Schlieffen as chief of staff, also had moments when he saw the truth as clearly. In a moment of heresy to Clausewitz, he said to the Kaiser in 1906, "It will be a national war which will not be settled by a decisive battle, but by a long, wearisome struggle with a country that will not be overcome until its whole national force is broken, and a war which will utterly exhaust our own people, even if we are victorious." It went against human nature, however, and the nature of general staffs, to follow through the logic of his own prophecy. Amorphous and without limits, the concept of a long war could not be scientifically planned for, as could the orthodox, predictable and simple solution of decisive battle and a short war. The younger Moltke was already chief of staff when he made his prophecy, but neither he nor his staff, nor the staff of any other country, ever made any effort to plan for a long war. Besides the two Moltkes, one dead and the other infirm of purpose, some military strategists in other countries glimpsed the possibility of prolonged war, but all preferred to believe, along with the bankers and industrialists, that because of the dislocation of economic life, a general European war could not last longer than 3 or 4 months. One constant among the elements of 1914, as of any era, was the disposition of everyone on all sides not to prepare for the harder alternative, not to act upon what they suspected to be true. Schlieffen, having embraced the strategy of decisive battle, pinned Germany's fate to it. He expected France to violate Belgium as soon as Germany's deployment at the Belgian frontier revealed her strategy, and he therefore planned that Germany should do it first and faster. "Belgian neutrality must be broken by one side or the other," his thesis ran. "Whoever gets there first and occupies Brussels and imposes a war levy of some 1,000 million francs has the upper hand." Indemnity, which enables a state to conduct war at the enemy's expense instead of its own, was a secondary object laid down by Clausewitz. His third was the winning of public opinion, which is accomplished by gaining great victories and possession of the enemy's capital, and which helps to bring an end to resistance. He knew how material success could gain public opinion. He forgot how moral failure could lose it, which too can be a hazard of war. It was a hazard the French never lost sight of, and it led them to the opposite conclusion from the one Schlieffen expected. Belgium was their pathway of attack too, through the Ardennes, if not through Flanders. But their plan of campaign prohibited their armies from using it, until after the Germans had violated Belgium first. To them, the logic of the matter was clear. Belgium was an open path in either direction. Whether Germany or France would use it depended on which of the two wanted war the more. As a French general said, "The one that willed more than the other could not help but will the violation of Belgian neutrality." Schlieffen and his staff did not think Belgium would fight and add its 6 divisions to the French forces. When Chancellor Bülow, discussing the problem with Schlieffen in 1904, reminded him of Bismarck's warning that it would be against plain common sense to add another enemy to the forces against Germany, Schlieffen twisted his monocle several times in his eye, as was his habit, and said, Of course, we haven't grown stupider since then. But Belgium would not resist by force of arms. She would be satisfied to protest, he said. German confidence on this score was due to placing rather too high a value on the well-known avarice of Leopold II, who was king of the Belgians in Schlieffen's time. Tall and imposing, with his black spade beard and his aura of wickedness, composed of mistresses, money, Congo cruelties and other scandals, Leopold was, in the opinion of Emperor Franz Joseph of Austria, a thoroughly bad man. There were few men who could be so described, the emperor said, but the king of the Belgians was one. Because Leopold was avaricious, among other vices, the Kaiser supposed that avarice would rule over common sense, and he conceived a clever plan to tempt Leopold into alliance with an offer of French territory. Whenever the Kaiser was seized with a project, he attempted instantly to execute it, usually, to his astonishment and chagrin, when it did not work. In 1904 he invited Leopold to visit him in Berlin, spoke to him in the kindest way in the world about his proud forefathers, the Dukes of Burgundy, and offered to recreate the old Duchy of Burgundy for him out of Artois, French Flanders, and the French Ardennes. Leopold gazed at him open-mouthed, then, attempting to pass it off with a laugh, reminded the Kaiser that much had changed since the 15th century. In any event, he said, his ministers and Parliament would never consider such a suggestion. That was the wrong thing to say, for the Kaiser flew into one of his rages and scolded the King for putting respect for Parliament and ministers above respect for the finger of God, with which William sometimes confused himself. "I told him," William reported to Chancellor von Bülow, "I could not be played with. Whoever in the case of a European war was not with me was against me." He was a soldier, he proclaimed, in the school of Napoleon and Frederick the Great, who began their wars by forestalling their enemies, and so should I, in the event of Belgium's not being on my side, be actuated by strategical considerations only. This declared intent, the first explicit threat to tear up the treaty, dumbfounded King Leopold. He drove off to the station with his helmet on back to front, looking to the aide who accompanied him as if he'd had a shock of some kind. Although the Kaiser's scheme failed, Leopold was still expected to barter Belgium's neutrality for a purse of £2 million. When a French intelligence officer, who was told this figure by a German officer after the war, expressed surprise at its generosity, he was reminded that the French would have had to pay for it. Even after Leopold was succeeded in 1909 by his nephew King Albert, a very different quantity, Belgium's resistance was still expected by Schlieffen's successors to be a formality. It might, for example, suggested a German diplomat in 1911, take the form of lining up her army along the road taken by the German forces. Schlieffen designated 34 divisions to take the road through Belgium, disposing on their way of Belgium's 6 divisions if, as seemed to the Germans unlikely, they chose to resist. The Germans were intensely anxious that they should not, because resistance would mean destruction of railways and bridges and consequent dislocation of the schedule to which the German staff was passionately attached. Belgian acquiescence, on the other hand, would avoid the necessity of tying up divisions in siege of the Belgian fortresses, and would also tend to silence public disapproval of Germany's act. To persuade Belgium against futile resistance, Schlieffen arranged that she should be confronted, prior to invasion, by an ultimatum requiring her to yield all fortresses, railways and troops, or face bombardment of her fortified cities. Heavy artillery was ready to transform the threat of bombardment into reality if necessary. The heavy guns would, in any case, Schlieffen wrote in 1912, be needed further on in the campaign. The great industrial town of Lille, for example, offers an excellent target for bombardment. Schlieffen wanted his right wing to reach as far west as Lille in order to make the envelopment of the French complete. "When you march into France," he said, "let the last man on the right brush the channel with his sleeve." Furthermore, counting on British belligerency, he wanted a wide sweep in order to rake in a British expeditionary force along with the French. He placed a higher value on the blockade potential of British sea power than on the British army, and therefore was determined to achieve a quick victory over French and British land forces and an early decision of the war before the economic consequences of British hostility could make themselves felt. To that end, everything must go to swell the right wing. He had to make it powerful in numbers, because the density of soldiers per mile determined the extent of territory that could be covered. Employing the active army alone, he would not have enough divisions both to hold his eastern frontier against a Russian breakthrough and to achieve the superiority in numbers over France, which he needed for a quick victory. His solution was simple, if revolutionary. He decided to use reserve units in the front line. According to prevailing military doctrine, only the youngest men, fresh from the rigors and discipline of barracks and drill, were fit to fight. Reserves who had finished their compulsory military service and returned to civilian life were considered soft and were not wanted in the battle line. Except for men under 26 who were merged with the active units, the reserves were formed into divisions of their own, intended for use as occupation troops and for other rear duty. Schlieffen changed all that. He added some 20 reserve divisions, the number varied according to the year of the plan, to the line of march of the 50 or more active divisions. With this increase in numbers, his cherished envelopment became possible. After retiring in 1906, he spent his last years still writing about Cannae, improving his plan, composing memoranda to guide his successors, and died at 80 in 1913, muttering at the end, "It must come to a fight. Only make the right wing strong." His successor, the melancholy General von Moltke, was something of a pessimist who lacked Schlieffen's readiness to concentrate all his strength in one maneuver. If Schlieffen's motto was, "Be bold, be bold," Moltke's was, "But not too bold." He worried both about the weakness of his left wing against the French and about the weakness of the forces left to defend East Prussia against the Russians. He even debated with his staff the advisability of fighting a defensive war against France, but rejected the idea because it precluded all possibility of engaging the enemy on his own territory. The staff agreed that the invasion of Belgium would be entirely just and necessary because the war would be won for the defense and existence of Germany. Schlieffen's plan was maintained, and Moltke consoled himself with the thought, as he said in 1913, that "we must put aside all commonplaces as to the responsibility of the aggressor. Success alone justifies war." But just to be safe everywhere, each year, cutting into Schlieffen's dying request, he borrowed strength from the right wing to add to the left. Moltke planned for a German left wing of 8 corps, numbering about 320,000 men, to hold the front in Alsace and Lorraine south of Metz. The German centre of 11 corps, numbering about 400,000 men, would invade France through Luxembourg and the Ardennes. The German right wing of 16 corps, numbering about 700,000 men, would attack through Belgium, smash the famed gateway fortresses of Liège and Namur, which held the Meuse, and fling itself across the river to reach the flat country and straight roads on the far side. Every day's schedule of march was fixed in advance. The Belgians were not expected to fight, but if they did, the power of the German assault was expected to persuade them quickly to surrender. The schedule called for the roads through Liège to be opened by the 12th day of mobilization, Brussels to be taken by M19, the 19th day of mobilization, the French frontier crossed on M22, a line at Thionville-Saint-Quentin reached by M31, Paris and decisive victory by M39. The plan of campaign was as rigid and complete as the blueprint for a battleship. Heeding Clausewitz's warning that military plans which leave no room for the unexpected can lead to disaster, the Germans, with infinite care, had attempted to provide for every contingency. Their staff officers, trained at maneuvers and at war college desks to supply the correct solution for any given set of circumstances, were expected to cope with the unexpected. Against that elusive, that mocking and perilous quantity, every precaution had been taken, except one: flexibility. While the plan for maximum effort against France hardened, Moltke's fears of Russia gradually lessened, as his general staff evolved a credo, based on a careful count of Russian railway mileage, that Russia would not be ready for war until 1916. This was confirmed in German minds by their spies' reports of Russian remarks that something was going to begin in 1916. In 1914, two events sharpened Germany's readiness to a fine point. In April, England had begun naval talks with the Russians, and in June, Germany herself had completed the widening of the Kiel Canal, permitting her new dreadnoughts direct access from the North Sea to the Baltic. On learning of the Anglo-Russian talks, Moltke said in May, during a visit to his Austrian opposite number, Franz Conrad von Hötzendorf, that from now on any adjournment will have the effect of diminishing our chances of success. 2 weeks later, on June 1st, he said to Baron Echard Stein, "We are ready, and the sooner the better for us." Chapter 3. The Shadow of Sedan. General de Castelnau, deputy chief of the French General Staff, was visited at the War Office one day in 1913 by the military governor of Lille, General Lebas, who came to protest the General Staff's decision to abandon Lille as a fortified city. Situated 10 miles from the Belgian border and 40 miles inland from the Channel, Lille lay close to the path that an invading army would take if it came by way of Flanders. In answer to General Lebas' plea for its defence, General de Castelnau spread out a map and measured with a ruler the distance from the German border to Lille by way of Belgium. The normal density of troops required for a vigorous offensive, he reminded his caller, was 5 or 6 to a meter. If the Germans extended themselves as far west as Lille, Dr. Castelnau pointed out, they would be stretched out 2 to a meter. "We'll cut them in half," he declared. The German active army, he explained, could dispose of 25 corps, about 1 million men on the Western Front. "Here, figure it out for yourself," he said, handing Lebas the ruler. "If they come as far as Lille," he repeated with sardonic satisfaction, "so much the better for us." French strategy did not ignore the threat of envelopment by a German right wing. On the contrary, the French general staff believed that the stronger the Germans made their right wing, the correspondingly weaker they would leave their centre and left, where the French army planned to break through. French strategy turned its back to the Belgian frontier and its face to the Rhine. While the Germans were taking the long way around to fall upon the French flank, the French planned a 2-pronged offensive that would smash through the German centre and left on either side of the German fortified area at Metz, and by victory there, sever the German right wing from its base, rendering it harmless. It was a bold plan born of an idea inherent in the recovery of France from the humiliation of Sedan. Under the peace terms dictated by Germany at Versailles in 1871, France had suffered amputation, indemnity, and occupation. Even a triumphal march by the German army down the Champs-Élysées was among the terms imposed. It took place along a silent, black-draped avenue empty of onlookers. At Bordeaux, when the French Assembly ratified the peace terms, the deputies of Alsace-Lorraine walked from the hall in tears, leaving behind their protest, "We proclaim forever the right of Alsatians and Lorrainers to remain members of the French nation. We swear for ourselves, our constituents, our children, and our children's children to claim that right for all time by every means in the face of the usurper." The annexation, though opposed by Bismarck, who said it would be the Achilles heel of the new German Empire, was required by the elder Moltke and his staff. They insisted, and convinced the Emperor, that the border provinces with Metz, Strasbourg, and the crest of the Vosges must be sliced off in order to put France geographically forever on the defensive. They added a crushing indemnity of 5 billion francs, intended to hobble France for a generation, and lodged an army of occupation until it should be paid. With one enormous effort, the French raised and paid off the sum within 3 years, and their recovery began. The memory of Sedan remained a stationary dark shadow on the French consciousness. N'en parlez jamais, pensez-y toujours. Never speak of it, Think of it always, had counseled Gambetta. For more than 40 years, the thought of again was the single most fundamental factor of French policy. In the early years after 1870, instinct and military weakness dictated a fortress strategy. France walled herself in behind a system of entrenched camps connected by forts. Two fortified lines, Belfort-Épinal and Toul-Verdun, guarded the eastern frontier, and one, Maubeuge-Valenciennes-Lille, guarded the western half of the Belgian frontier. The gaps between were intended to canalize the invasion forces. Behind her wall, as Victor Hugo urged at his most vibrant, France will have but one thought, to reconstitute her forces, gather her energy, nourish her sacred anger, raise her young generation to form an army of the whole people, to work without cease, to study the methods and skills of our enemies, to become again a great France, the France of 1792, the France of an idea with a sword. Then one day she will be irresistible. Then she will take back Alsace-Lorraine. Through returning prosperity and growing empire, through the perennial civil quarrels, royalism, Boulangism, clericalism, strikes, and the culminating, devastating Dreyfus affair, the sacred anger still glowed, especially in the army. The one thing that held together all elements of the army, whether old guard or republican, Jesuit or Freemason, was the mystique d'Alsace. The eyes of all were fixed on the blue line of the Vosges. A captain of infantry confessed in 1912 that he used to lead the men of his company in secret patrols of two or three through the dark pines to the mountain tops, where they could gaze down on Colmar. On our return from those clandestine expeditions, our columns reformed, choked and dumb with emotion. Originally, neither German nor French, Alsace had been snatched back and forth between the two, until under Louis XIV it was confirmed to France by the Treaty of Westphalia in 1648. After Germany annexed Alsace and part of Lorraine in 1870, Bismarck advised giving the inhabitants as much autonomy as possible and encouraging their particularism, for he said the more Alsatian they felt, the less they would feel French. His successors did not see the necessity. They took no account of the wishes of their new subjects, made no effort to win them over, administered the provinces as Reichsland, or imperial territory, under German officials on virtually the same terms as their African colonies, and succeeded only in infuriating and alienating the population until in 1911 a constitution was granted them. By then it was too late. German rule exploded in the Zabern affair in 1913, which began, after an exchange of insults between townspeople and garrison, when a German officer struck a crippled shoemaker with his sabre. It ended in the complete and public exposure of German policy in the Reichsland, in a surge of anti-German feeling in world opinion, and in the simultaneous triumph of militarism in Berlin, where the officer of Zabern became a hero, congratulated by the Crown Prince. For Germany, 1870 was not a final settlement. The German day in Europe, which they thought had dawned when the German Empire was proclaimed in the Hall of Mirrors at Versailles, was still postponed. France was not crushed. The French Empire was actually expanding in North Africa and Indochina. The world of art and beauty and style still worshipped at the feet of Paris. Germans were still gnawed by envy of the country they had conquered. As well off as God in France, was a German saying. At the same time, they considered France decadent in culture and enfeebled by democracy. It is impossible for a country that has had 42 war ministers in 43 years to fight effectively, announced Professor Hans Delbrück, Germany's leading historian. Believing themselves superior in soul, in strength, in energy, industry, and national virtue, Germans felt they deserved the dominion of Europe. The work of Sedan must be completed. Living in the shadow of that unfinished business, France, reviving in spirit and strength, grew weary of being eternally on guard, eternally exhorted by her leaders to defend herself. As the century turned, her spirit rebelled against 30 years of the defensive, with its implied avowal of inferiority. France knew herself to be physically weaker than Germany, Her population was less, her birth rate lower. She needed some weapon that Germany lacked to give herself confidence in her survival. The idea with a sword fulfilled the need. Expressed by Bergson, it was called élan vital, the all-conquering will. Belief in its power convinced France that the human spirit need not, after all, bow to the predestined forces of evolution, which Schopenhauer and Hegel had declared to be irresistible. The spirit of France would be the equalizing factor. Her will to win, her élan, would enable France to defeat her enemy. Her genius was in her spirit, the spirit of La Gloire of 1792, of the incomparable Marseillaise, the spirit of General Marguerite's heroic cavalry charge before Sedan, when even Wilhelm I, watching the battle, could not forbear to cry, "Oh, les braves gens!" Belief in the fervour of France, in the furor Gallici, revived France's faith in herself in the generation after 1870. It was that fervour, unfurling her banners, sounding her bugles, arming her soldiers, that would lead France to victory if the day of again should come. Translated into military terms, Bergson's élan vital became the doctrine of the offensive. In proportion as a defensive gave way to an offensive strategy, the attention paid to the Belgian frontier gradually gave way in favour of a progressive shift of gravity eastward toward the point where a French offensive could be launched to break through to the Rhine. For the Germans, the roundabout road through Flanders led to Paris. For the French, it led nowhere. They could only get to Berlin by the shortest way. The more the thinking of the French general staff approached the offensive, the greater the forces it concentrated at the attacking point, and the fewer it left to defend the Belgian frontier. The doctrine of the offensive had its fount in the École Supérieure de la Guerre, or War College, the arc of the army's intellectual elite, whose director, General Ferdinand Foch, was the moulder of French military theory of his time. Foch's mind, like a heart, contained two valves. One pumped spirit into strategy, the other circulated common sense. On the one hand, Foch preached a mystique of will, expressed in his famous aphorisms, "The will to conquer is the first condition of victory," or more succinctly, "Victoire, c'est la volonté," and "A battle won is a battle in which one will not confess oneself beaten." In practice, this was to become the famous order at the Marne to attack when the situation called for retreat. His officers of those days remember him bellowing, "Attack! Attack!" with furious, sweeping gestures while he dashed about in short rushes as if charged by an electric battery. Why, he was later asked, did he advance at the Marne when he was technically beaten? Why? I don't know. Because of my men, because I had a will, and then God was there. Though a profound student of Clausewitz, Foch did not, like Clausewitz's German successors, believe in a foolproof schedule of battle worked out in advance. Rather, he taught the necessity of perpetual adaptability and improvisation to fit circumstances. "Regulations," he would say, "are all very well for drill, but in the hour of danger they are no more use. You have to learn to think." To think meant to give room for freedom of initiative, for the imponderable to win over the material, for will to demonstrate its power over circumstance. But the idea that morale alone could conquer, Foch warned, was an infantile notion. From his flights of metaphysics he would descend at once, in his lectures and his pre-war books, Les Principes de la Guerre and La Conduite de la Guerre, to the earth of tactics, the placing of advance guards, the necessity of sûreté or protection, the elements of firepower, the need for obedience and discipline. The realistic half of his teaching was summed up in another aphorism he made familiar during the war. De quoi s'agit-il? What is the essence of the problem? Eloquent as he was on tactics, it was Foch's mystique of will that captured the minds of his followers. Once, in 1908, when Clemenceau was considering Foch, then a professor, for the post of director of the War College, a private agent whom he sent to listen to the lectures reported back in bewilderment, "This officer teaches metaphysics so abstruse as to make idiots of his pupils." Although Clemenceau appointed Foch in spite of it, there was in one sense truth in the report. Foch's principles, not because they were too abstruse but because they were too attractive, laid a trap for France. They were taken up with particular enthusiasm by Colonel Grandmaison, an ardent and brilliant officer who was director of the Troisième Bureau, or Bureau of Military Operations, and who in 1911 delivered two lectures at the War College which had a crystallizing effect. Colonel Grandmaison grasped only the head and not the feet of Foch's principles. Expounding their élan without their sûreté, he expressed a military philosophy that electrified his audience. He waved before their dazzled eyes an idea with a sword, which showed them how France could win. Its essence was the offensive à outrance, offensive to the limit. Only this could achieve Clausewitz's decisive battle, which exploited to the finish is the essential act of war, and which, once engaged, must be pushed to the end with no second thoughts up to the extremes of human endurance. Seizure of initiative is the sine qua non. Preconceived arrangements based on a dogmatic judgment of what the enemy will do are premature. Liberty of action is achieved only by imposing one's will upon the enemy. All command decisions must be inspired by the will to seize and retain the initiative. The defensive is forgotten, abandoned, discarded. Its only possible justification is an occasional economizing of forces at certain points with a view to adding them to the attack. The effect on the general staff was profound, and during the next 2 years was embodied in new field regulations for the conduct of war and in a new plan of campaign called Plan 17, which was adopted in May 1913. Within a few months of Grandmaison's lectures, the President of the Republic, Monsieur Falliere, announced, "The offensive alone is suited to the temperament of French soldiers. We are determined to march straight against the enemy without hesitation." The new field regulations, enacted by the government in October 1913 as the fundamental document for the training and conduct of the French army, opened with a flourish of trumpets. "The French army, returning to its traditions, henceforth admits no law but the offensive." 8 commandments followed, ringing with a clash of decisive battle, offensive without hesitation, fierceness and tenacity, breaking the will of the adversary, ruthless and tireless pursuit. With all the ardour of orthodoxy stamping out heresy, the regulations stamped upon and discarded the defensive. The offensive alone, it proclaimed, leads to positive results. Its 7th commandment, italicized by the authors, stated, "Battles are beyond everything else struggles of morale. Defeat is inevitable as soon as the hope of conquering ceases to exist. Success comes not to him who has suffered the least, but to him whose will is firmest and morale strongest." Nowhere in the 8 commandments was there mention of materiel or firepower or what Foch called sûreté. The teaching of the regulations became epitomized in the favorite word of the French officer corps, le cran, nerve, or, less politely, guts. Like the youth who set out for the mountaintop under the banner marked Excelsior, the French army marched to war in 1914 under a banner marked cran. Over the years, while French military philosophy had changed, French geography had not. The geographical facts of her frontiers remained what Germany had made them in 1870. Germany's territorial demands, William I had explained to the protesting Empress Eugenie, have no aim other than to push back the starting point from which French armies could in the future attack us. They also pushed forward the starting point from which Germany could attack France. While French history and development after the turn of the century fixed her mind upon the offensive, her geography still required a strategy of the defensive. In 1911, the same year as Colonel Grandmaison's lectures, a last effort to commit France to a strategy of the defensive was made in the Supreme War Council by no less a personage than the commander-in-chief designate, General Michel. As vice-president of the Council, a post which carried with it the position of commander-in-chief in the event of war, General Michel was then the ranking officer in the army. In a report that precisely reflected Schlieffen's thinking, He submitted his estimate of the probable German line of attack and his proposals for countering it. Because of the natural escarpments and French fortifications along the common border with Germany, he argued, the Germans could not hope to win a prompt, decisive battle in Lorraine. Nor would the passage through Luxembourg and the near corner of Belgium east of the Meuse give them sufficient room for their favoured strategy of envelopment. Only by taking advantage of the whole of Belgium, he said, could the Germans achieve that immediate, brutal and decisive offensive which they must launch upon France before the forces of her allies could come into play. He pointed out that the Germans had long yearned for Belgium's great port of Antwerp, and this gave them an additional reason for an attack through Flanders. He proposed to face the Germans along a line Verdun-Namur-Antwerp, with a French army of 1 million men whose left wing, like Schlieffen's right, should brush the channel with its sleeve. Not only was General Michel's plan defensive in character, it also depended upon a proposal that was anathema to his fellow officers. To match the numbers he believed the Germans would send through Belgium, General Michel proposed to double French frontline effectives by attaching a regiment of reserves to every active regiment. Had he proposed to admit Mistinguett to the immortals of the French Academy, he could hardly have raised more clamour and disgust. Les réserves, c'est zéro, was the classic dogma of the French officer corps. Men who had finished their compulsory training under universal service and were between the ages of 23 and 34 were classed as reserves. Upon mobilization, the youngest classes filled out the regular army units to war strength. The others were formed into reserve regiments, brigades and divisions according to their local geographical districts. These were considered fit only for rear duty or for use as fortress troops, and incapable, because of their lack of trained officers and NCOs, of being attached to the fighting regiments. The regular army's contempt for the reserves, in which it was joined by the parties of the right, was augmented by dislike of the principle of the nation in arms. To merge the reserves with the active divisions would be to put a drag on the army's fighting thrust. Only the active army, they believed, could be depended upon to defend the country. The left parties, on the other hand, with memories of General Boulanger on horseback, associated the army with coup d'état and believed in the principle of a nation in arms as the only safeguard of the republic. They maintained that a few months' training would fit any citizen for war and violently opposed the increase of military service to 3 years. The army demanded this reform in 1913, not only to match an increase in the German army, but also because the more men who were in training at any one time, the less reliance needed to be placed on reserve units. After angry debate, with bitterly divisive effect on the country, the 3-year law was enacted in August 1913. Disdain of the reserves was augmented by the new doctrine of the offensive, which it was felt could only be properly inculcated in active troops. To perform the irresistible onslaught of the attaque brusque, symbolized by the bayonet charge, the essential quality was élan, and élan could not be expected of men settled in civilian life with family responsibilities. Reserves mixed with active troops would create armies of decadence, incapable of the will to conquer. Similar sentiments were known to be held across the Rhine. The Kaiser was widely credited with the edict, "No fathers of families at the front." Among the French general staff, it was an article of faith that the Germans would not mix reserve units with active units, and this led to the belief that the Germans would not have enough men in the front line to do two things at once, send a strong right wing in a wide sweep through Belgium west of the Meuse, and keep sufficient forces at their centre and left to stop a French breakthrough to the Rhine. When General Michel presented his plan, the Minister of War, Messimy, treated it to commune insanité. As chairman of the Supreme War Council, he not only attempted to suppress it, but at once consulted other members of the Council on the advisability of removing Michel. Messimy, an exuberant, energetic, almost violent man, with a thick neck, round head, bright peasant's eyes behind spectacles and a loud voice, was a former career officer. In 1899, as a 30-year-old captain of chasseurs, he had resigned from the army in protest against its refusal to reopen the Dreyfus case. In that heated time, the officer corps insisted as a body that to admit the possibility of Dreyfus's innocence after his conviction would be to destroy the army's prestige and infallibility. Unable to put loyalty to the army above justice, Messier-Me determined upon a political career with the declared goal of reconciling the army with the nation. He swept into the war ministry with a passion for improvement. Finding a number of generals incapable not only of leading their troops but even of following them, he adopted Theodore Roosevelt's expedient of ordering all generals to conduct maneuvers on horseback. When this provoked protests that old so-and-so would be forced to retire from the army, Messier-Me replied that that was indeed his object. He'd been named war minister on June 30, 1911, after a succession of four ministers in 4 months, and the next day was met by the spring of the German gunboat Panther on Agadir, precipitating the second Moroccan crisis. Expecting mobilization at any moment, Messier-Me discovered the generalissimo designate, General Michel, to be hesitant, indecisive, and crushed by the weight of the duty that might at any moment devolve upon him. In his present post, Messier-Me believed he represented a national danger. Michel's insane proposal provided the excuse to get rid of him. Michel, however, refused to go without first having his plan presented to the council, whose members included the foremost generals of France: Gallieni, the great colonial; Pau, the one-armed veteran of 1870; Joffre, the silent engineer; Dubail, the pattern of gallantry, who wore his képi cocked over one eye with the chic exquis of the Second Empire. All were to hold active commands in 1914, and two were to become marshals of France. None gave Michel's plan his support. One officer from the war ministry, who was present at the meeting, said, "There's no use discussing it. General Michel is off his head." Whether or not this verdict represented the views of all present, Michel later claimed that General Dubail, for one, had originally agreed with him, Messier-Me, who made no secret of his hostility, carried the council with him. A trick of fate arranged that Messier-Me should be a forceful character and Michel should not. To be right and overruled is not forgiven to persons in responsible positions, and Michel duly paid for his clairvoyance. Relieved of his command, he was appointed military governor of Paris, where in a crucial hour in the coming test he was indeed to prove hesitant and indecisive. Messier-Me, having fervently stamped out Michel's heresy of the defensive, did his best as war minister to equip the army to fight a successful offensive, but was in his turn frustrated in his most cherished prospect, the need to reform the French uniform. The British had adopted khaki after the Boer War, and the Germans were about to make the change from Prussian blue to field grey. But in 1912, French soldiers still wore the same blue coats, red képi and red trousers they'd worn in 1830, when rifle fire carried only 200 paces, and when armies fighting at these close quarters had no need for concealment. Visiting the Balkan front in 1912, Messier-Me saw the advantages gained by the dull-coloured Bulgarians, and came home determined to make the French soldier less visible. His project to clothe him in grey, blue or grey-green raised a howl of protest. Army pride was as intransigent about giving up its red trousers as it was about adopting heavy guns. Army prestige was once again felt to be at stake. To clothe the French soldier in some muddy, inglorious colour, declared the army's champions, would be to realise the fondest hopes of Dreyfusards and Freemasons. "To banish all that is colourful, all that gives the soldier his vivid aspect," wrote the Echo de Paris, "is to go contrary both to French taste and military function." Messier-Me pointed out that the two might no longer be synonymous, but his opponents proved immovable. At a parliamentary hearing, a former war minister, Monsieur Etienne, spoke for France. "Eliminate the red trousers," he cried. "Never. Le pantalon rouge, c'est la France." "That blind and imbecile attachment to the most visible of all colours," wrote Messier-Me afterward, "was to have cruel consequences." In the meantime, still in the midst of the Agadir crisis, he had to name a new prospective generalissimo in place of Michel. He planned to give added authority to the post by combining with it that of Chief of the General Staff, and by abolishing the post of Chief of Staff to the War Ministry, currently held by General Dubai. Michel's successor would have all the reins of power concentrated in his hands. Messimi's first choice was the austere and brilliant general in pince-nez, Gallieni, who refused it, because, he explained, having been instrumental in Michel's dismissal, he felt scruples about replacing him. Furthermore, he had only 2 years to go before retirement at 64, and he believed the appointment of a colonial would be resented by the Metropolitan Army, une question de bouton, he said, tapping his insignia. General Pau, who was next in line, made it a condition that he be allowed to name generals of his own choice to the higher commands, which, as he was known for his reactionary opinions, threatened to wake the barely slumbering feud between rightist army and republican nation. Respecting him for his honesty, the government refused his condition. Messimi consulted Gallieni, who suggested his former subordinate in Madagascar, a cool and methodical worker with a lucid and precise mind. Accordingly, the post was offered to General Joseph Jacques César Joffre, then aged 59, formerly Chief of the Engineer Corps, and presently Chief of the Services of the Rear. Massive and paunchy in his baggy uniform, with a fleshy face adorned by a heavy, nearly white moustache and bushy eyebrows to match, with a clear, youthful skin, calm blue eyes, and a candid, tranquil gaze, Joffre looked like Santa Claus, and gave an impression of benevolence and naivete, two qualities not noticeably part of his character. He did not come of a gentleman's family, was not a graduate of Saint-Cyr, but of the less aristocratic, if more scientific, École Polytechnique, had not passed through the higher training of the War College. As an officer of the Engineer Corps, which dealt with such unromantic matters as fortifications and railways, he belonged to a branch of the service not drawn upon for the higher commands. He was the eldest of the 11 children of a petit bourgeois manufacturer of wine barrels in the French Pyrenees. His military career had been marked by quiet accomplishment and efficiency in each post he filled, as company commander in Formosa and Indochina, as a major in the Sudan and Timbuktu, as staff officer in the railway section of the War Ministry, as lecturer at the artillery school, as fortifications officer under Gallieni in Madagascar from 1900 to 1905, as general of a division in 1905, of a corps in 1908, and as director of the rear and member of the War Council since 1910. He had no known clerical, monarchist, or rather disturbing connections. He'd been out of the country during the Dreyfus affair. His reputation as a good republican was as smooth as his well-manicured hands. He was solid and utterly phlegmatic. His outstanding characteristic was a habitual silence that in other men would have seemed self-deprecatory, but worn like an aura over Joffre's great calm bulk, inspired confidence. He had still 5 years to go before retirement. Joffre was conscious of one lack. He had no training in the rarefied realms of staff work. On a hot July day, when doors in the War Ministry on the Rue Saint-Dominique were left open, officers glancing out of their room saw General Pau holding Joffre by a button of his uniform. "Take it, cher ami," he was saying. "We will give you Castelnau. He knows all about staff work. Everything will go of itself." Castelnau, who was a graduate both of Saint-Cyr and of the War College, came, like D'Artagnan, from Gascony, which is said to produce men of hot blood and cold brain. He suffered from the disadvantage of family connections with a marquis, of associating with Jesuits, and of a personal Catholicism, which he practiced so vigorously as to earn him during the war the name of Le Capucin Botté, the monk in boots. He had, however, long experience on the general staff. Joffre would have preferred Foch, but knew Messimi to have an unexplained prejudice against him. As was his habit, he listened without comment to Pau's advice and promptly took it. "Aye," complained Messimi, when Joffre asked for Castelnau as his deputy chief. "You will rouse a storm in the parties of the left and make yourself a lot of enemies." However, with the assent of the President and Premier, who made a face at the condition but agreed, both appointments were put through together. A fellow general, pursuing some personal intrigue, warned Joffre that Castelnau might displace him.
"Get rid of me?
Not Castelnau," Joffre replied, unruffled. "I need him for 6 months, then I'll give him a corps command." As it proved, he found Castelnau invaluable, and when war came, gave him command of an army instead of a corps. Joffre's supreme confidence in himself was expressed in the following year when his aide, Major Alexandre, asked him if he thought war was shortly to be expected.
"Certainly, I think so," Joffre replied. "I have always thought so. It will come. I shall fight it, and I shall win. I've always succeeded in whatever I do, as in the Sudan. It will be that way again."
"It will mean a marshal's baton for you," his aide suggested with some awe at the vision.
"Yes," Joffre acknowledged the prospect with laconic equanimity.
Under the aegis of this unassailable figure, the General Staff, from 1911 on, threw itself into the task of revising the field regulations, retraining the troops in their spirit, and making a new plan of campaign to replace the now obsolete Plan 16. The Staff's guiding mind, Foch, was gone from the War College, promoted and shifted to the field, and ultimately to Nancy, where, as he said, the frontier of 1870 cut like a scar across the breast of the country. There, guarding the frontier, he commanded the 20th Corps, which he was soon to make famous. He left behind, however, a chapel, as cliques in the French army were called, of his disciples who formed Joffre's entourage. He'd also left behind a strategic plan which became the framework of Plan 17. Completed in April 1913, it was adopted without discussion or consultation, together with the new field regulations by the Supreme War Council in May. The next 8 months were spent reorganizing the army on the basis of the plan and preparing all the instructions and orders for mobilization, transport, services of supply, areas and schedules of deployment and concentration. By February 1914, it was ready to be distributed in sections to each of the generals of the five armies into which the French forces were divided, only that part of it which concerned him individually going to each one. Its motivating idea, as expressed by Foch, was, "We must get to Berlin by going through Mainz, that is, by crossing the Rhine at Mainz, 130 miles northeast of Nancy." That objective, however, was an idea only. Unlike the Schlieffen plan, Plan 17 contained no stated overall objective and no explicit schedule of operations. It was not a plan of operations, but a plan of deployment with directives for several possible lines of attack for each army, depending on circumstances, but without a given goal. Because it was in essence a plan of response, of riposte to a German attack, whose avenues the French could not be sure of in advance, it had of necessity to be, as Joffre said, a posteriori and opportunist. Its intention was inflexible attack, otherwise its arrangements were flexible. A brief general directive of five sentences, classified as secret, was all that was shown in common to the generals who were to carry out the plan, and they were not permitted to discuss it. It offered very little for discussion. Like the field regulations, it opened with a flourish. "Whatever the circumstance, it is the Commander-in-Chief's intention to advance with all forces united to the attack of the German armies." The rest of the general directive stated merely that French action would consist of two major offensives, one to the left and one to the right of the German fortified area of Metz-Thionville. The one to the right, or south of Metz, would attack directly eastward across the old border of Lorraine, while a secondary operation in Alsace was designed to anchor the French right on the Rhine. The offensive to the left or north of Metz would attack either to the north or, in the event the enemy violated neutral territory, to the northeast through Luxembourg and the Belgian Ardennes, but this movement would be carried out only by order of the commander-in-chief. The general purpose, although this was nowhere stated, was to drive through to the Rhine, at the same time isolating and cutting off the invading German right wing from behind. To this end, Plan 17 deployed the five French armies along the frontier from Belfort in Alsace as far as Hirson, about a third of the way along the Franco-Belgian border. The remaining two-thirds of the Belgian frontier, from Hirson to the sea, was left undefended.